Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times, and ours. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 11. Of In This Labyrinth. I am, as always, your host, Phantom Femme, and as always, huge thanks to everyone who's tuned back in from previous episodes, and of course, to all new listeners, too. And while I'm at it, can I just say, wow, I've apparently passed 500 downloads now. That is awesome. So thank you all so much for that. And please keep it coming. That is fantastic. And that's in spite of this episode being, yet again, out a bit later than I meant it to be, too, which is awesome. So thank you all as well for your persistence and patience. Much appreciated. I meant to have this episode out right at the beginning of March in time for International Women's Day, as I think I might have mentioned in the previous episode, but IRL craziness, and that didn't quite happen. Because 50 students' papers to mark, which I know is actually fairly small compared to what some teachers and teaching assistants have, but believe me, when you have to do it with accessibility stuff added and whatnot, it does slow it down. And then, plus, there's been all kinds of busyness and angst around the moving, or the upcoming moving. The good news is, yay, as soon as I accept the offer, I do now have an apartment, so thank goodness, that's good, at least, but there's still plenty more stress and craziness to go around actually getting moved in. So the next couple of months are still going to be kind of interesting until that gets done. And on that note, I actually have a GoFundMe campaign up to help cover the costs of the move, and I'll put the link to that in the show notes blog and also in the extended description for this episode. And yeah, if I may be so presumptuous, any contributions to that would be seriously helpful because, yeah, there will be costs associated with moving. Thank God the apartment that we're moving into, because it's student housing, doesn't require a deposit, but, you know, I still need to pay the movers in order to get all my stuff from where I am now up to there. So, yeah, any contributions, if I may be so bold, would be incredibly helpful, and thanks in advance for that. Anyway, that all being said, I am back, and thanks everyone again for all your patience with all this, and I have for you what I hope will be a very interesting and exciting and hopefully enjoyable episode. So let's get on to that, and I'll do all the other usual logistical and housekeeping stuff at the end. Okay, so because it was International Women's Day this month, I want in this episode to talk about gender in Phantom, because I haven't really talked about that yet. And I think there's some really interesting stuff to explore there. And in particular, for this discussion, I want to talk about what Phantom does with femininity. I will, of course, talk about what it does with masculinity too at some point, because there's lots of interesting stuff to explore there as well. But that's fodder for a whole other episode, which I will definitely do, but I'm not sure when yet. But yeah, for now, I want to talk about what Phantom does with femininity, and in particular, I want to talk about what the original LaRue novel, of course the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical, and the novel by Susan Kay do with femininity, because I think they all do really interesting and really similar, although not absolutely identical, of course, things with it. And what's so interesting is that Phantom is often accused by those who don't love it like us fans do of being sexist, even misogynist, in the way that it portrays particularly Christine. But I, of course, disagree with that criticism. And in fact, it seems to me that all these three versions, the LaRue novel, the Lloyd Webber stage musical, and the Susan Kay, actually contain a very subtle and perhaps unintended by their authors, gender critique or critique of traditional gender norms. And so that's what I want to talk about and explore here, is how they do that. Because like with so much in Phantom, it's not stated directly. You have to really look for it and kind of read between the lines to find it, which, as I said, makes me suspect that the gender critique sort of snuck in there as part of the way the characters and the storytelling developed, rather than actually being intended by any of the authors or creators. Although, that being said, I would be really interested to know and to research whether or not Gaston LaRue, through his days as a journalist, was aware of the movement for women's suffrage and what he thought of it. And of course, with regard to the Andrew Lloyd Webber stage musical, Gillian Lynn was a woman in what was then, and probably still is now, although hopefully less so, a very male-dominated field of music theater choreography. So I can't help but wonder if that had an influence. And likewise with Maria Bjornsson in the field of set and costume design. And that's really interesting, because in some ways, the gender critique is the hardest to spot in the Lloyd Webber stage musical because of the way that there's leeway for different actresses to play Christine more or less sort of damsel in distress-ly. But it's also the version in which the gender critique is maybe the most powerful. And I'll get to how I get that later on. I don't just say that because the LW stage musical is my favorite version. But, as I said, I'll get to how I get that later on. In all three of the versions that I'm talking about, though, the LaRue, the Lloyd Webber, and the Susan Kay, it's a little bit like what I was talking about last episode when I talked about how, with regard to relationships in Phantom, the status quo, the sort of normative idea of a romantic relationship, is foregrounded, and to find the critique, to find the alternative, you kind of have to look in the negative space created by what's not said explicitly or directly. Well, the same thing is very much true here with what Phantom does with femininity. The dominant normative ideas of femininity are very much foregrounded, and then you kind of have to play spot the hints and read between the lines to find the critiques and alternatives. And I have to say that, as so often with Phantom, the way that this is done is truly brilliant. So, as I said, what's foregrounded are the dominant normative ideas of femininity. And in the LaRue novel and ALW stage musical, those dominant ideas are very much represented by the contrast between Christine and Carlotta. The Susan Kay novel does it slightly differently, and I'll get to that in a bit. But yeah, in LaRue and the Lloyd Webber stage musical, normative, dominant ideas of femininity are very much presented through the contrasting of Carlotta and Christine. And what they portray is the good girl slash bad girl binary, or you'll sometimes hear it called the angel whore binary or the Madonna whore binary. Madonna referring to the Virgin Mary, the Christian figure of the Virgin Mary, not the pop singer. And this is one of those classic binary oppositions that have shaped Western thought for centuries alongside and related to good slash evil, black slash white, male slash female, straight slash queer, that sort people, in this case women, woman presenting, woman identified people, into two categories, into absolutely and only two categories, with no room for blurring or subtlety or nuance. And also, these are oppositional binaries, where one side of the binary is constructed as desirable and the other as undesirable. And as the name good girl slash bad girl binary might suggest, this is no exception. So I would suggest that the good girl side of this opposition is very much represented by Christine. And what is she? Well, for one thing, she's quote-unquote pure, which not only means that she's a virgin in the sense that she hasn't had sex yet, but in some ways more importantly, it means she's virginal, meaning that even though she's a fully grown woman, she either has not yet experienced sexual desire, or if she has, she's so repressed slash disconnected from her own body that she doesn't recognize or understand it for what it is. Also, she's sweet-natured and gentle, and desires to please people, especially to please men, but not please men in a sexual way, please men in a domestic, keeping the peace, keeping contentment, maintaining harmony and smoothing over conflict kind of way. Additionally, she has no ambition of her own, or at least none that can't easily and happily be swept aside when she meets Mr. Right. And indeed, instead of sexual fantasies or desires, she has wedding fantasies of meeting and marrying Mr. Right. Most importantly, though, the man that she dreams of is someone safe and socially acceptable, who can provide her with a stable home where she can fulfill her destiny as wife and mother. Good girls do not love or desire deformed outcasts like Eric. They might feel pity or even compassion for them, but they do not love and desire deformed outcasts like the Phantom. Oh, and of course, she's able-bodied and beautiful. And you can very much see all of that in the character of Christine, especially in LaRue. You can see it in ALW as well, but the Lloyd Webber stage musical also complicates the character of Christine a bit, and I'll get to that later. Plus, of course, there's variety in the way different actresses play her. Some actresses play her very innocent and virginal, and some less so. Some complicate her more. But LaRue very much emphasizes not only Christine's physical beauty, but her innocence and naivety as well. And of course, I'll put specific references for that in the show notes. So then, the other side of the binary, the bad girl side, is, I would argue, represented by Carlotta. And what's really interesting, and I have to thank Mom for pointing this out to me, is that LaRue very subtly but clearly, and the Lloyd Webber stage musical picks up on this, sets Christine and Carlotta up as two sides of the same coin. And he does that by linking Christine to the figure of Little Lottie, who, of course, is the little girl that Christine's late father is always telling her stories about, and who is the sort of ultimate good girl that Christine, I think it's implied, is trying to emulate, to be like, so that she can both please her father and someday maybe be worthy of hearing the angel of music. But of course, Lottie, L-O-T-T-E, can also be a nickname for Charlotte, Charlotte, or Carlotta. So it seems to me that that very much and very deliberately sets these two characters up as two sides of the same coin, as two sides of this binary. With Christine representing the quote-unquote good, socially desirable side, and Carlotta representing being her opposite, the bad girl. So where Christine, little Lottie, is sweet-natured and gentle, the bad girl, Carlotta, is hard and ambitious and cold-hearted. And she's materialistic. She wants wealth and prestige and power, either through attaching herself to a powerful man or, as seems to be the case with Carlotta and Phantom, in her own right through being a star, or perhaps both. In addition, she's sensual. And in fact, in many, if not most, versions of the bad girl, she's a quote-unquote slut. So someone who has sex outside of respectable marriage and or somebody who enjoys, a woman who enjoys sex, because good girls aren't supposed to. Interestingly enough, though, LaRue doesn't emphasize that aspect of the bad girl so much in Carlotta. He more emphasizes her materialisticness and ambition, rather than portraying her as a quote-unquote loose woman. Though, that being said, there are a couple of passages, phrases really, in LaRue that may, in that very 19th and early 20th century oblique way, allude to or hint at Carlotta's sexuality. So, for example, there's the part in Chapter 2, A New Margarita, D'Amato's translation, where LaRue's talking about how mysterious Christine's triumph was in the gala performance, and LaRue describes Christine as having, up till that point, played an okay Cybele to Carlotta's, quote, rather too splendidly material Marguerite, unquote. And of course, he's referring to Gounod's opera Faust, in which Marguerite is a young girl who's basically seduced by pretty jewelry into having an illicit affair. And whereas many sopranos, including Christine, obviously, play the role very innocently and purely, LaRue is suggesting that Carlotta plays the character in a much more worldly way. And then in Chapter 7 of the D'Amato's translation of LaRue, the chapter whose title he translates as Faust and What Followed, in the part where LaRue is describing Carlotta's performance, again, of Faust, the role of Marguerite in Faust, leading up to the part where she loses her voice just before the chandelier falls, and he's talking about Carlotta's certainty in her expectation of triumphing in this performance, LaRue is, and he says, quote, Carlotta flung herself into her part without restraint of modesty. She was no longer Marguerite, she was Carmen, unquote. And of course, for those who know opera, Carmen is the quote-unquote gypsy lead female character from Georges Bizet's opera, Carmen, who loves and has affairs with whomever she pleases and refuses to be bound to any one man, and, incidentally, gets killed at the end of the opera by a jealous Don Jose. So, as I said, these little references, especially that latter one where LaRue compares Carlotta to the character of Carmen, may be subtle allusions to her sexuality, but mostly LaRue portrays Carlotta as just cold and heartless and ambitious and materialistic. In that same Faust and What Followed chapter, he describes her as, quote, the heartless and soulless diva, unquote. And, as I said before, this is, of course, contrasted to Christine's, little Lottie's, innocence and purity and naivety and desire to please those around her. And, of course, the Lloyd Webber musical picks up on this and portrays these two characters very much the same way. Carlotta is basically the diva bitch who wants to be in the spotlight at any cost, even as she fancies herself the artiste. Think Act 1, Scene 7, the first note scene into Prima Donna, where that's conveyed not only in her lines, in her lyrics, but also in the music of her part, which is not only very high, but very showy. Whereas Christine's character skews much more toward the innocent and virginal. So, for example, a lot of her lyrics convey a certain innocence and naivety. Think Angel of Music, Act 1, Scenes 2 and 3, or the rooftop scene, Act 1, Scene 10. But also her music, because although her part is very much written in a soprano register, it's quite plain musically. It's not bravura and showy like Carlotta's part. And in the Western musical tradition, at least, that combination of soprano register but plain is often used to symbolize innocence and purity. Now, the novel by Susan Kay, as I said before, also presents this good girl, bad girl binary, but it does so in a slightly different way than LaRue and the ALW. It doesn't contrast Christine and Carlotta, because in fact, Carlotta plays quite a minor role in the Susan Kay novel. Instead, it contrasts or juxtaposes Christine with the other women in Eric's life. Because for those unfamiliar with it, the Susan Kay novel is in many ways a prequel that tells Eric's, the Phantom's, life from the moment of his birth through Persia, through his time in the gypsy fairs, through his relationship with Christine and right to his death and beyond. So it contrasts or juxtaposes Christine with Eric's mother, Luciana, who is the daughter of the stonemason with whom Eric apprentices for a time, and with the Khanum, the Queen of Persia, rather than with Carlotta. And in fact, it occurs to me that in the Kay novel, these three women kind of take on or are given some of the attributes that that LaRue gives to Carlotta in the original, because as I said, Carlotta herself, actually, the sort of rivalry between Christine and Carlotta actually plays a fairly small part in the Kay novel. And so it occurs to me, thinking about it now, that some of Carlotta's attributes are given instead to these other women in Eric's life who are contrasted with Christine, because they're all kind of divas. Actually, they're all very definitely divas. So Eric's mother, Madeleine, and Luciana are kind of similar in that they're not really malicious, they're just spoiled brats. They're used to being pampered and kind of coddled. They're used to being the center of attention and admiration. They're not materialistic in the sense of quote-unquote whoring, quote-unquote, after fame or success, but they are materialistic in the sense that they're used to being surrounded by beauty and perfection, and they're used to not having to ever deal with or confront anything less than beauty and perfection. And so this makes them kind of shallow and superficial and not really able or willing to look past the appearance of things. Now, Madeleine, Eric's mother, does ultimately learn differently. She does ultimately learn to do differently, but too late. And no, I won't explain what that means because that would be too much of a spoiler. And of course, Luciana never learns differently. She never gets the chance. So those two women, Luciana and Eric's mother, typify one kind of quote-unquote bad quote-unquote woman. The little princess who, as I said earlier, isn't really malicious. She's just spoiled and shallow and self-centered, self-focused. The Khanum, on the other hand, the Queen of Persia, represents a different kind of bad woman. The femme fatale, the deadly woman. And in contrast to Eric's mother and Luciana, she is malicious. She's ruthless, she's cruel, and she enjoys manipulating and using people, and she enjoys seeing other people suffer and be humiliated. And it's interesting, like Carlotta in LaRue and Lloyd Webber, Luciana and Eric's mother aren't really portrayed as sluts, just as kind of selfish, thoughtless, shallow, spoiled brats. whereas the Khanum, like many femme fatale, is kind of hypersexualized. And she's exoticized as sort of the dangerous, alluring other who exudes sexuality. And it's sort of implied that the only thing keeping her from being a slut, from acting on that hypersexuality, is the rules of her society. Because if she did, she would lose all her power and social position, and she doesn't want that. And so, instead, like many other femme fatale characters, she uses her allure, she uses her exuding of sexuality, and she uses the fact that those social rules don't allow people, men, to access that sexuality. She uses all those things as weapons to manipulate people and to control people. And she certainly does that to Eric in that section of the novel. And I should say that Kay is taking her cue from LaRue here in what LaRue alludes to with regard to, quote-unquote, the little Sultana, quote-unquote, whom LaRue says Eric entertained with the Punjab lasso and the torture chamber during the, quote-unquote, rosy hours of Mazenderan, quote-unquote. And, yeah, in the chapters and passages that talk about Eric's time in Persia, LaRue definitely alludes to the little Sultana being this sort of exotic, depraved, cruel, possibly hypersexual woman. And so Kay very definitely takes her cue from LaRue there and builds on those hints and allusions and fleshes the little Sultana, in this case the Khanum, out into a full-fledged character. And, as I said, she emerges in the Kay novel as this kind of classic femme fatale. Only in this case, instead of the femme fatale being conquered and tamed by the hero, Eric has to flee and escape from her. Now, I'm going to do a whole other episode at some point on the way that this femme fatale character is racialized in both LaRue and Kay, because there are some things about that that are rather problematic, making this femme fatale character the exotic other from the East. And in fact, the way that Persia, the East, the quote-unquote Orient, is set up in both LaRue and Kay as this exotic land of licentiousness and depravity. So yes, I will definitely be addressing that at some point on the show. But suffice it for now to say that in the Khanum, Kay kind of gives us the classic bad girl, bad woman. The cruel, manipulative, power-hungry slut who's just out to ensnare men for her own gain. So these three women characters in Kay, then, are of course contrasted against Christine, whom Kay sets up, and she's not subtle about it either, as the good version of Madeline, the good version of Eric's mother. And just as an aside, I have to say that is one of my few criticisms of Susan Kay. I feel like, wow, she's been reading way too much Freud. Anyway, yeah, Christine. Here too, like in LaRue and ALW, Christine is the quote-unquote good girl. Quote unquote. She's innocent, she's naive, she's sheltered by her doting father rather than being a spoiled brat, and she's repressed so that when she does begin to experience desire, it takes her a long time to even recognize those feelings for what they are, much less begin to understand or accept them, and in fact, in some ways, she never comes to fully understand and accept those feelings. Or if she does, like Madeline at the beginning, she learns too late. And of course, rather than give extensive spoilers here, I'll put all the info in the show notes so you guys can go read for yourself what I mean. And I'll do that for the parts of LaRue and ALW that I was referring to as well. So all that I've talked about thus far is how, as I said earlier, LaRue, Kay, ALW very much foreground the status quo in terms of femininity. They very much foreground the norm, the dominant ideas about what femininity is. But remember I also suggested earlier that I believe there is actually a critique of those normative dominant ideas of what femininity is hidden, as I said before, you might say, in the negative space of what's not said. So what then is that? What is that critique? Well, in a nutshell, it is that none of these dominant versions of womanhood, these dominant versions of femininity, produce a person who is capable of loving someone like Eric. And what's interesting is, of course, that's obvious of the quote-unquote bad quote-unquote women, Carlotta, Madeline, Luciana, the Canum, etc., because they're spoiled, selfish, self-centered, and or greedy, materialistic bitches. But the twist is that it's also true of the quote-unquote good girls, quote-unquote, the Christines. And LaRue and Kay portray this particularly brilliantly, that having been stuffed into this 19th century ideal of the quote-unquote pure, quote-unquote innocent ingenue, has left them kind of stuck, nothing kind of about it, has left them really stuck in the space of a prepubescent 10, 11, or 12-year-old and really unable to handle complex adult emotions and desires. It's made them docile and obedient, except in situations where their virtue is being questioned or threatened, or in situations where they believe that it is, which is the only context in which a quote-unquote good girl, especially the 19th century version, can legitimately contradict or disobey a man. But it's also left them stuck within a very narrow range of socially acceptable feelings and desires. Religious devotion, devotion to family, desexualized romantic love, and of course defense of honor and virtue, but lacking the tools to process and to deal with feelings and desires that fall outside of that narrow range, and therefore frightened by them. And you can see that very much both in the LaRue and the Kay Christines. Their encounters with Eric trigger feelings in both of them that fall outside of those of that narrow range of socially acceptable feelings and desires. And in both cases, they totally don't know what to do with it and are, in fact, frightened by those feelings. And I think you can see that in the Lloyd Webber stage musical Christine as well. But also, being bound into this quote-unquote good girl role leaves Christine's lacking the emotional and intellectual tools to help them learn to look past surface appearances. And that leaves them unable to deal with ugliness, either physical or social. It leaves them with a very simplistic worldview in which what they've been taught to regard as beautiful represents safety, and what they've been taught to regard as, or what they find as ugly, represents danger, or is understood to be dangerous. And of course, this simplistic worldview and this stunting of their emotions and desires leaves canon Christine's totally unable to handle the kind of emotional and social complexity that goes with someone like Eric, someone who carries trauma, who carries stigma, who carries social marginalization, and who carries the mental and physical and emotional and spiritual scars of trauma and stigma and marginalization and exclusion. So, as I said back at the beginning, I think there's this really interesting critique or criticism of the traditional good girl, bad girl, or angel whore, or Madonna whore binary in all three of these versions of Phantom, LaRue, Kay, and Lloyd Webber's stage musical, because they present both sides of that binary, bad girl and good girl, as inadequate. they really show how neither side of that binary produces a whole person capable of whole and healthy love. And interestingly enough, as I mentioned back at the beginning too, I think the Lloyd Webber stage musical actually even takes this critique or questioning of the good girl, bad girl binary one step farther, because LaRue certainly drops hints that Christine has an inner strength and that she could have been more than this ingenue good girl role allowed her to be. And I think Kay does too, in the way that she ultimately does come to love Eric, even if it's too late. But as I suggested earlier, the Lloyd Webber stage musical actually gives you a tantalizing hint of what that more might be. And you guessed it, it does so in the title song, Act 1, Scene 4. Because there, as I suggested in a previous episode, you have this shift into this quasi-rock song, which is a change, which is a shift from the style of the rest of the show, which suggests that it does more than just convey plot, that suggests that it's also a kind of a time out of time from the main body of the narrative. You'll recall I talked about that back in episode 5, and one of the things I would suggest that it's doing in that time out of time, that the title song is doing in that time out of time from the main narrative, as part of giving us that those tantalizing glimpses of the relationship that could be between the Phantom and Christine, is giving us a glimpse of Christine freed from that good girl, bad girl binary. Because, as I mentioned back in that episode, you've got those lines in the third and fourth verses that I'll quote in the show notes, in the show notes blog, that suggest her having an understanding of some of the complexities of that relationship around Eric's, the Phantom's face, his deformity, and around the role play aspect of their relationship. And you've also got her singing for most of the song way down in her lower register, in fact, below middle C. It's one of the few, and maybe the only time that happens in the entire show. And in the Western musical tradition, that alto range, that lower end of a woman's voice, is often used to symbolize or to signify sexuality and sensuality. And in fact, in opera and music theater, bad girl roles are very often cast as altos using that lower register. And even in the last part of the song, when she does go way up into her high register, it's much closer to a rock riff than to the more traditional way that Christine's upper register is used in the rest of the show. And so these musical and lyrical details suggest to me that we're getting in the title song a glimpse of a Christine, or otherwise romantic partner for the Phantom, who is in touch with and confident in their own desires, and who's not frightened by those desires when they fall outside the mainstream, or when they fall outside of dominant ideas of what desire and romance and love should be. And also who's able to deal with emotional complexity, and perhaps with a greater degree of social complexity as well. So it seems to me then that we're getting a glimpse in the title song of what it might be like or have been like if Christine were able to, or if the Phantom's romantic partner were able to, as he puts it in the next scene in Music of the Night, let their darker side give in. Now, sadly, like with so many of the most awesome things about the Lloyd Webber stage musical, all you get is that tantalizing little glimpse in the title song. And it's once again left to the audience's, the fans' imagination to extrapolate what that might look like fully realized. The rest of the show, meanwhile, goes back and shows us what all too often is the tragic consequences for both the Phantom and for Christine herself of being trapped in this rigid binary where there's only two options of role models for women. Because the way that that binary operates to keep Christine naive and unaware and kind of ignorant really contributes to both the Phantom and her going through way more hell than necessary. And as feminist writers have well documented, that's been true for many, many women throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, and is even still true today. Although not nearly as much as it used to be, thanks to the efforts of many, many women activists throughout the past 100 years. Actually more than 100 years now. So yeah, women and girls of my generation and younger generations are starting to have more options available to us than just either the good girl ingenue or the bad woman femme fatale. And in the Phantom world, I think we're starting to see that reflected in Phantom fanfic, but I'd love to see that reflected in Phantom fanfic a whole lot more so. So, yeah, challenge to all the fanfic writers out there. So, I hope you've all enjoyed this discussion of Phantom and gender and femininity. I hope you've all found it interesting. I hope it's given everyone out there at least something to think about, hopefully lots to think about. And, as always, I would love to hear your thoughts and feedback on this episode, or, of course, on any of the previous episodes, too. And there are, of course, lots of ways that you can get in touch with the show. You can tweet at the show at ITL Podcast, and, of course, you can also follow the show on Twitter at ITL Podcast. And you can also, of course, like or follow the Facebook page for the show and, or hopefully, and join the Facebook group for the show, too. And both of those, the page and the group, are named with the title of the podcast, In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Ours. And you should, I hope, be able to find them by searching the whole title or just In This Labyrinth. And there are links to the Facebook page and to the Twitter feed as well from the podcast website, which is https://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm. So you can check that out as well. Also, and I keep forgetting to mention this, the show is now up on both iTunes and Google Play. So you can subscribe to it there. And of course, you can also leave a rate and review on both of those. And I would be ever so grateful if folks would leave rates and reviews on iTunes and Google Play, because that will help boost the show in their search algorithm, whatevers, and that will help more people find the show and listen to it, which, of course, would be awesome. And last but not least, I'm also now up on Patreon as well. So if you enjoy the show and you want to give it some support there, that would be really awesome, and thank you very much. You can find it at www.patreon.com/phantomfemme. That's PHANTOMFEMME. And there should be a link to my Patreon on the podcast website, too. So, yeah, I hope you've all enjoyed this episode. And I really hope you'll tune back in for the next episode, because that one's going to be really exciting. I'm really looking forward to putting it out. However, it's not quite going to be what I said. I know I said the last couple of episodes that I would do my review of The Angel's Flight, the sequel to The Angel's Shadow, that I beta listened the audiobook of back in January. And I am going to get to that, but not next episode. Things had to get reshuffled a bit because of things being time sensitive. So for next episode, to coincide with and lead up to their book launch, yay, I'm going to be airing my first interview. Sadly, not with the chap from Toronto Disability Pride yet. That still has yet to be arranged. because he's really busy right now planning his wedding. So, yeah, congratulations to him and his fiancé on that. But we haven't, because of that, we haven't yet had a chance to arrange getting him on the show. So instead, I'll be airing an interview that I just recorded with a wonderful friend and colleague of mine, local Toronto artist, activist, author, Bridget Liang, about the young adult novel they just put out, which partially features a high school production of Phantom Idea. So I'm really excited about that. It was an awesome interview, and I'm really excited to share it with you guys. So stay tuned for that next episode, and then hopefully the episode after that, I will do the review of Angel's Flight, which, by the way, is now out in audiobook. The paperback and ebook versions came out a couple of weeks ago, as some of you may have seen on the Facebook and Twitter. But I just got word from the author that the audiobook version is now out as well. So that is awesome. And as I said, I'll get to the review of that, hopefully the episode after next. And in the meantime, stay tuned for next episode, which will be my interview with Bridget. So yeah, lots to look forward to in the near future. So thanks again very much for listening, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I've enjoyed producing it. And have a fantastic and phantom-filled time till next time. Disclaimer: the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, the Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, the Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.